This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. This is Booktown on KPMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm going to be with you for a little over 50 minutes talking some exciting new books, mostly on California topics and particular California natural history. The University of California Press has been revising its California Natural History Guides. You may have heard me rave about several of these in the past, like the Geology of the Sierra Nevada, which is out in a new edition. Generally, these were small books, maybe 100, 120 pages in the past, thin with a few pictures. The new series is coming out closer to 300 pages when you have, or more, when you have all the appendices, bibliographies, indexes, and so on, and just crammed with pictures. And there's two of them that I want to feature this afternoon. One of them is The Introduction to California Chaparral. It's by Ronald D. Quinn and Sterling G. Keeley. Ronald Quinn is professor of biological sciences at Cal State Polytechnic University in Pomona, and Sterling Keeley is professor of botany at the University of Hawaii. I've got Ronald Quinn with me this afternoon, and we're going to spend 15-20 minutes finding out more about California Chaparral. Welcome to Booktown.
Hello.
As I said, it's a big, thick book full of pictures, full of fascinating information about what is chaparral. I think most people might have a vague idea that if the Central Valley is like a great big bathtub, the chaparral zone is sort of like the ring that was left when somebody got out. But it occurs in other parts of California, too, and it's a very distinct ecosystem. How would you define it?
Chaparral is a community of native California shrubs, confined almost exclusively to California, that grows at middle elevations, primarily on hillsides at various locations throughout the state, but most commonly along the coast and intermediate ranges from about the San Francisco Bay Area or slightly north. All the way down across the international border into Mexico.
And you mentioned that it is really a distinctly Mediterranean climate.
Oh, it is. It's as Californian as a redwood tree or the Hollywood sign. It is one of the cardinal features of the natural landscape of this state. But unlike, say, a live oak tree or a California redwood, it just isn't as widely understood or appreciated by the public, which was one of the reasons that we wrote this book.
When I said a Mediterranean climate, you do point out that there are other places in the world, like Chile and the Mediterranean, and South Africa, and a few others, parts of Australia, where there's similar vegetation, but nowhere where there's as much as there is here.
Well, that's not
Well, I guess Mediterranean
quite accurate.
Maybe.
The Mediterranean basin itself is larger even than the state of California, and has more Mediterranean-specific vegetation. As you just said, there are four other places besides California that have the same climate, and they have, we've been talking only about vegetation, but they have a biota, let's say, plants and animals, these areas that have considerable similarity to what we find here in California. They're not the same, but they have the same general appearance.
They look a lot the same, and you say that this is an example of convergence where similar climates bring forth similar adaptations.
Exactly so. A number of years ago, there were a whole lot of people in California and in Chile that did research on that to see whether or not the striking similarities between the Mediterranean areas of the two continents had anything to do with common ancestry or was something that was propelled by evolution to the same situations. And it turned out to be the latter, convergent evolution.
So what are the distinctive, first the shrubs that define chaparral, and then what are the other life forms?
Oh, well, the shrubs, which is usually what people think about when they think of chaparral because they're always there, are woody. They're called shrubs rather than trees because they have multiple stems from the ground and are not as tall as trees, although the tallness can vary. They are evergreen, and the leaves that they have on them are tough. They're thick, leathery, and don't wilt in the absence of water, which, of course, is necessary in a place where, for most of the year, there is no soil moisture because there isn't any precipitation. And they tend to grow in continuous, even-aged stands that blanket hillsides so that they look rather uniform from the distance, like a blanket. The plants are all more or less the same height. The other things that are in chaparral include a myriad of herbaceous plants and short-lived perennial plants that only grow after fire. It's a different world after fire, and there are more kinds of plants, and there are more plants that produce a kaleidoscope of various kinds of colors. I guess the best-known one would be California poppies, and second, lupins. Most people know what they are, and a good time and place to see those is the first year or two after a chaparral wildfire. In terms of animals, there's less known about animals, and the groups of animals that are well known, such as birds and mammals, for the most part are not unique to chaparral, but include chaparral in a wider menu of habitats. There are a few hallmark animals that only occur in chaparral, but most are not exclusively chaparral animals. And as far as the other creatures, things like insects, more difficult to say because we just don't know as much about insects anywhere in the world as we do about other kinds of organisms.
And you make a very clear distinction between chaparral and the coastal sage plants.
Yes, we did that because I'm talking to you from Southern California, so in our end of the state there is another plant community that superficially resembles chaparral and has received a lot of attention because most of it has fallen directly to urbanization. It's at lower elevations on private land, and we just don't have very much of it left here. And consequently, there's a long list of species that are threatened and endangered that occur in coastal sage scrub. And a whole lot of attention has been accorded to the conservation biology of what's left. However, it isn't chaparral. It is shorter in stature. There are spaces between the shrubs. It's summer deciduous, which means most or all of the leaves come off during the summer drought. What it does have in common is that it burns, often in the same fires as chaparral, and it contains some of the same species of animals, but the plant community is quite different.
And what you alluded to a couple of minutes ago was that there's a strong connection between chaparral and fire, the whole question of fire prevention and extinction has been really heated in California in recent years, and there's a whole question of maybe we should let many of the forests burn. As far as the chaparral is concerned, it absolutely has to burn. If it doesn't occasionally burn, it will disappear. Or am I reading that?
Well, there are people who would disagree with the tail end of your sentence, that it would disappear without fire. It's a little hard to tell, because in reality it's very, very difficult to find chaparral that goes more than about a century without fire. Sooner or later, it all burns. So the ultimate question of whether or not it has to burn is moot. It does burn, and so we can't find out directly. And that is, when fire does occur in chaparral, that's the one time when it draws everyone's attention, particularly when it's near urban areas, because that's when it becomes a direct problem, sometimes a genuine threat to us. Chaparral fires sometimes turn into urban fires around the edges and cause all sorts of losses from one end of the state to the other.
Early in the book, you have a sort of chart of the root systems of chamise, manzanita, and ceanothus, the most common chaparral shrubs, which the root systems go very, very far into the ground and I guess prevent erosion. And one of the problems with fire is immediately after fire, there's a big danger of erosion, especially if you've got a house on some of this recently exposed land.
Well, there is, and that one is even more difficult for people, including the people that live in houses that may be in high-risk areas, to grasp, because the floods are improbable anywhere for various reasons, but when they do occur, they can be extremely destructive, and I can tell that you've had a close look at the book, and there are some stories in there of genuine disasters that have been based on what happened after the fire rather than during the fire, and it was always floods. Floods not in the sense of the ones that occurred in New Orleans that were just water that rose higher than barriers around it. These are floods that come rushing down off from steep hillsides, especially below canyons, and are a sort of slurry with mud and boulders and uprooted trees and all sorts of other things in them. And it becomes a sort of juggernaut, a mountain of material that just batters and buries everything in its course very quickly, in a matter of minutes, just like flash floods that most people know occur in the Southwest. These are sort of flash mud floods. I just made that up.
And that's particularly unusual because we think of the chaparral area as being so dry. And you also point out that there's a distinction between the life forms or the climate actually right on top of the chaparral shrubs and that at their base. But both of them are very dry, and it's only when they disappear that the water has a chance to really wreak havoc. And I guess the animals and the other plants that live in a chaparral area adapt either to the hot, dry surface at the top or the cooler ground level, but even the ground level is still quite dry.
Well, they do. The animals, because they can move around, don't solve the same sets of problems the way plants do. Almost all animals respond to what we ecologists call microclimates. They go to places that are suitable to them in one way or another. So they may be underground during the summer or underground during the day or down in some rock crevice or nearer to a canyon or some other place that contains the circumstances, the physical circumstances and the resources that they need to get along. The one that they all have to deal with sooner or later is fire. So there isn't anything on a landscape that involves chaparral that either cannot survive the fire or find a way to return if they don't survive in the area where it burned. Otherwise, they wouldn't be here.
The middle of the book, we've been talking mostly about the climate, the microclimates, the determining species, and the fire question. But in the middle of the book, you have two sections on plants and animals, and that actually takes up more than two-thirds of it. It's almost like a the chaparral equivalent of the Sierra Nevada Natural History.
Well, I can tell you how that came about. As you pointed out, the University of California Press is putting out a series of books, some that are new and some that are revised versions of older ones, that deal with the natural, all aspects of the natural history of the state. And what we tried to do with this book, and the reason it's called Introduction rather than Field Guide, is to have some elements of an explanation of how to identify and learn something about the common plants and animals without implying in the format or in the title that this is a book where if you saw it out there, you could find it in the book and figure out what it was. So we tried to cover the most commonly observed and interesting plants and animals of chaparral in those two long chapters in the center. And that's what the all of the photographs and line drawings, or the majority of them, are about that you alluded to in the introduction to the series. So we're conforming with the desires of the press and the intention of the two kinds of books. They do put out, University of California Press is publishing field guides as well as these natural history introductions, and ours is one of the latter.
You mentioned we live at about 2,500 feet elevation, which is a bit higher than most of the chaparral. But we have big chunks of ceanothus and manzanita in particular in among the predominantly pines and other conifers, but mm-hmm. also some stands of oak a little farther south.
Mm-hmm.
So chaparral is not just, I described it earlier, sort of a ring around the bathtub, but it also pops up here and there among those other ecosystems.
Well, the farther north you go, either in the coast ranges or along the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, the chaparral becomes more fragmented. There are pieces of it rather than large continuous expanses, and that has to do with local conditions of things like soil, fire history, maybe previous or present land uses like grazing, logging. And so there are places that have patches of chaparral that look just like chaparral anywhere else. But if you turn your head a little bit, you'll see a coniferous forest or a grassy meadow or some other kind of circumstance. So it's more mixed up with other communities the farther one goes north.
I don't know if ecologists still speak of climax species or climax situations, but in an area like ours where there's chaparral mixed in with the pine and the oak, is it evolving in one direction or another?
It could be, and sometimes it is, and sometimes it's hard to tell if it takes a long time. The kinds of studies that would document that are difficult, which is why historical ecologists often need to resort to old photographs and things to determine exactly what's happening. In terms of all of the things that a classical climax community implies, in my opinion, it's not a useful idea for chaparral or for most of the other communities in California and the western United States, which is kind of another conversation, but it's not helpful most of the time to imagine what you're seeing on a landscape as either being something that'll be there forever, which it won't, or something that is gradually changing towards something which will then will be there forever, because that won't happen either. In most of California, for no other reason, because a fire will come along and change everything, reset everything again to some other set of conditions.
Okay, well, thanks so much for talking with us. I've been talking with Ronald Quinn, one of the two authors with Sterling Keeley of Introduction to California Chaparral. It's a wonderful new guidebook just out from the University of California Press. In a couple of minutes, I'll be back with another one of these books, David Carl, talking about Introduction to Air in California. Thank you, Professor Quinn.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Hi, that cough you just heard in the back, he didn't know he was already on the air, but that belongs to David Carl, who's the second of our guests on Booktown this afternoon. As I've been raving about these new California Natural History Guides, and the one that Professor Carl has written is called An Introduction to Air in California. And it covers everything from where the air came from, what the different air regions are, called air basins, and then, of course, to all the problems we're having in our air these days. Air is a particular concern to us up in Nevada County. I don't know if you knew where I was calling from.
Yes, I knew.
Okay, because we are considered a pristine, natural, rural area, but I think we have, in some categories, the 13th worst air in the entire United States, because of mostly stuff that comes up from the Sacramento Valley.
Transported, yes. Yeah.
Yes, and I guess that's what air does. It blows around from here to there.
Yes, it does. And in fact, one of the things that's in this book I think of interest to what you're just talking about is there's a whole central section in the book that looks at each of the air basins in California, including what's called the Mountain Counties Air Basin that you fall within. And one of the things it does is try to look at the differences in air in terms of air quality and, you know, the character of the air that for people living there, but also identify these patterns where air does not just stay within these basins. It finds its way out and transports things across. And so, unfortunately, yes, you're right, the Mountain Counties Air Basin gets pollutants sent up from the Sacramento Valley, and some of that is also originating all the way over in the San Francisco Bay Area.
And it's amazing what very small quantities will do. You have a chart here of the most 10 most common components of dry air. Nitrogen is 78%. Oxygen is 20-some percent. Between them, they're over 99%. And argon is the next biggest one, almost 1%. And all the others that worry us so much, like carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and so on, are just tiny. The carbon dioxide is 37/1000ths of a percent.
Right, and yet it has such a tremendous impact in terms of its role in the greenhouse effect and controlling this process that we're doing now, that we're this big experiment we're undergoing on the globe right now with climate change. All of those things you just mentioned are the natural gases that are in air. And then you can add in these other trace things, which are the real, are some of the additional, real concerns, the pollutants that are in addition to those gases that you're just listing.
Now, those gases weren't always there in that quantity. There are different layers of the air, but let's just keep to the lowest, our own troposphere, where most of what we do occurs, going up about 10 miles. It's started out being with a very, very small amount of oxygen, and the oxygen has only, well, I guess, come up in the last 4 or 5 billion years.
Right, yeah. Now you're talking about how we got the atmosphere that we have today, and I think one of the interesting parts of that whole story is the connection between life and the evolution of life on the planet and the evolution of this atmosphere as we know it today, because they're so intimately connected. And the oxygen that we focus so much on, although I think it's intriguing that, you know, we tend to focus on the oxygen in air as sort of the most important thing, and yet most of it is nitrogen gas. But anyway, the oxygen could only be there after or as the process of evolution of photosynthesis occurred, that process in plants that produces oxygen by pulling carbon dioxide out of the air and combining it with water, with the sun's energy to build complex carbon molecules, but also give off oxygen. And so that had to happen at a sufficient quantity to begin to build up a surplus. And the only way you get a surplus out of this balancing of respiration and photosynthesis and these things that keep cycling these is if you sequester some of it. And that's actually something we hear a lot about right now in relation to carbon dioxide, this sequestering of carbon dioxide to keep it from building up so much. Well, that same, in a sense, that a same kind of process was necessary to put some of the carbon dioxide away as what became, for example, our fossil fuels that we are now releasing and tapping.
capture that, get it out away, and therefore then there, the other side of the equation where oxygen is coming off could build up in a surplus and build up to the current 21% level that we depend on so much.
So initially, billions of years ago, the atmosphere was mostly nitrogen and carbon dioxide.
Yes, and other things, methane and various things that, again, the key here that I would focus on is that wonderful, magical, well, not magical, but that incredible process of photosynthesis. That when I first learned about it way back in probably middle school and in some science class, at the time it seemed to me like one of the answers to the universe, and it really is so amazing that we have this ongoing process where plants run one direction. Plants have their respiration, and animals, of course, reverse the equation of photosynthesis by using oxygen to burn up carbon molecules. That's how we keep our metabolisms going, and in the process giving off the carbon dioxide and water that are the beginnings of the process for photosynthesis. It's wonderfully elegant in how it balances.
I'm just curious to put our current worries about carbon dioxide into perspective. What was the maximum? Does anyone know what the maximum amount of carbon dioxide ever was?
They have some numbers. I'm no expert on this, but way back, there have been periods where carbon dioxide levels have been higher than where it is now. The very different set of circumstances of what was going on in terms of life and in terms of the atmosphere at the time, as I understand it. The interesting, one of the intriguing things is to look back, where we can go look back about 600,000 years or more now through these records that they're pulling out of the ice packs. And anybody who's been following this story or maybe seen the Al Gore movie has seen some of this information. But through that last, half a million or 500,000 or more years of records, carbon dioxide levels never did get above that 300 parts per million. That when you translate that into the percentages you were describing earlier, that's that 0.003 that seems so small. Now we're up to 370. And so when you graph that on a very long scale of hundreds of thousands of years, and then you look at the last several decades, all of a sudden the spike looks enormous, jumping, and it has not exceeded, been at that level in this very long record. If you go far enough back, into millions of years back, yes, there were periods where it was. So it's the spike that is of real concern right now, of course, because that we haven't stopped at 370 where we are right now. We're racing on by that, and we're heading for 500, and we're heading beyond that. And how far it goes all depends on what we choose to do about climate change and emissions of carbon dioxide in the next few years.
Now, the other pollution problems in California seem more or less under control. I thought it was amusing that when Earl Warren in the mid-40s began suggesting that the state do something to control the smog in the L.A. basin, the Angelino said, no, we don't want the state interfering. This is our problem. And now we're so used to the state having emission controls and things to bring down various nitrous oxides and sulfuric and carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. It seems that we've gotten most of that, the stuff that is really visibly unpleasant, is slowly coming under control. But what's the chance of doing that with carbon dioxide?
Well, with carbon dioxide, the chance depends on a lot of things. Can I step back to the original assumption in the question, though? We have made tremendous steps along the lines of controlling photochemical smog. That the first thing that was first identified back when Earl Warren was getting worked up about it back around the World War II period in Southern California. While we have reduced those smog levels down to where the most severe cases aren't happening anymore, we still, we don't want to be complacent because we still have never got things to the level where we are at the healthy level. We are still too many days of the year in these various air basins, people are breathing unhealthy levels of ozone, which is what we're talking about with that particular thing called smog. And as the years have gone by, more and more concern is building up around particulates, very fine particles. And it's too early. They're way too early to say that we've gotten control of that. There's things that are being done. One very important one this summer, we switched over. A transition occurred to switch over to an ultra low sulfur diesel fuel for all of the vehicles operating on diesel, and that's going to help. And all of these things are helping, but it's really not correct to say that we've gotten on top of it that well. If we had, we wouldn't have. The air board people say that we are seeing thousands, literally thousands of people dying in California each year, every year after year, too early because of air, things related to pollutants in the air. And we have a real epidemic of asthma in our young children, particularly in these air basins most affected. So that bad news out there aside, we are doing a lot of good things. Meanwhile, we've got the current focus that's so important on the climate change situation too, and whether we can get on top of those emissions has a lot to do with these opportunities you're hearing about, these decisions about things that California has recently passed some major legislative steps that are not in effect yet, but will be going into effect to reduce emissions from both vehicles and from static stationary sources.
I'm talking with David Caro, the author most recently of Introduction to Air in California. He's also the author earlier of another book in the California Natural History series of Introduction to Water in California, which unfortunately I have not seen, but I read there was a rather scary article in the New Yorker a week or so ago about increasing carbon dioxide concentrations in the oceans.
Yes.
Is that it looks like there's no way we can turn.
Well, yeah, the oceans have done us a favor in a sense. They've absorbed a tremendous amount of the increase in carbon dioxide emissions that we have been putting out. But while they absorb it, which means there's less up there overhead to act as greenhouse gases, it's affecting the ocean itself. And the story there is part of the story is that it's turning the ocean acidic. I went to a conference just recently. Talk about things that scare you and where you hear things. And there was talk about just how fine that balance is, where if you just tip the pH balance, the acid, towards more acidity in the ocean, and what that does to so many things. We hear a lot about
you started to say plankton?
I was going to go to plankton, but we also hear a lot about when you go snorkeling around and you see all that.
The coral?
The coral. There's the word my brain wouldn't come up with. Yeah, we hear a lot about coral, and there's been this leaching of coral. Some of that's related to temperature and acidity. But then, yeah, the plankton is even more, to me, more scary because that's the fundamental basis of the food chain in the oceans, which, of course, is the fundamental basis of a lot of what goes on in the whole planet, beginning with the ocean. So if we mess up, I saw these pictures projected showing what happens with these plankton under these conditions. And if we mess that up, that's a very scary thing. That's not a good sign.
So you'll admit that we have made slight changes in or improvements in some of the other pollutants. What do we do about CO2?
Well, there's a number of real interesting things. One of the first things is that transportation is a big part of the picture. And so that's why you hear a lot of talk about focusing on gas mileage on cars. I can't vouch for this. I've heard a number of people in a number of places in the last couple of years say that someone has calculated that if right away we went immediately to the kind of mileage that a Toyota Prius, for example, can generate up in the 50-plus miles per gallon, that one step alone would take this country's emissions down to a level, reduce them to about 60%. And that's a figure you're hearing among the scientists saying that if we want to get on top of this and avoid the worst things to come and the kind of the centuries of effects that are coming, if we can rather quickly reduce our emissions by something that sounds incredible, by 60%, we would be on the right track. But while it sounds incredible, this one, you know, example of something that could be done in terms of vehicles is doable. It would be a very big change, of course. There are other options, though, out there, too. People are hearing about the opportunities for hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. While we've been hearing that it's always way out in the future, I'm real skeptical about the projections that come that way from the auto industry, because as my air book describes, I've done some looking into the history of how the auto industry has reacted every time they've been pushed to improve things along these lines. And it's always been, doom and gloom. Oh, it'll destroy our industry to do things, and yet somehow we got catalytic converters and we got a whole lot of good things to happen. And I'm hearing some very intriguing things in the not-too-distant future, the next few years, about commercially available hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Hans is working on one, including a system for generating your own fuel right at home with solar cells and that kind of thing. That fuel is, I don't know how much you know about that or your listeners do, but the attraction there is you generate the fuel from something like water, and you give off only water vapor, essentially, because it's not an internal combustion engine. It's not burning fossil fuels. So.
This is Booktown on KBMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking with David Carl, author of Introduction to Air in California. It's one of the new, greatly expanded California Natural History Guides, and a very, very comprehensive book. We barely even talked about clouds or lightning or where the winds come from and where they go and so many other things.
I'd like to mention that the books, they are in the Natural History Guide series. So if people think about, field guides, they're kind of the smaller-sized books. But what these books offer that I do want to mention is a tremendous number of illustrations, color photographs on almost every page, or else color diagrams and drawings and things. And I'm really pleased with what the whole series of Natural History Guides is doing to make all of these books very, really beautiful to work with. And I think the first thing someone in a bookstore will notice is they pick them up is that the pictures will catch their attention, and hopefully then the text will get read as a follow-up to that.
Well, thanks so much, David Carl. We have to move on now from natural history to history, but I've very much enjoyed discussing the Introduction to Air in California.
Thank you very much.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've got to be here just another 13 minutes or so. A listener just called in to ask the price of these books, the California Natural History Guides. They're both a bit pricey as hardbacks. The Introduction to California Chaparral is $45, and the Introduction to Air is $50. But they are both $19.95 as paperbacks, and as paperbacks go these days, that's a very reasonable price. I talked a little while ago with Maria Brower, who's a former director of the Nevada City Doris Foley Historical Library and a prominent member of Nevada County Historical Society. She's written a couple of books for Arcadia Publishing, which publishes very small-run books on individual American towns, or sometimes on even districts. Like I believe in San Francisco, they have something like, there's one on the Sunset, there's one on the Noe Valley, there's one on Chinatown, and so on. But she has written two about Nevada City and then about Gold Rush towns in Nevada County. She's going to be appearing twice this coming weekend in the area. She'll be at Toad Hall Books this Saturday, the 2nd of December, from noon to 3, and she'll be at the Bookseller in Grass Valley from 1 to 3 on Sunday the 3rd. When we were talking, I started asking her about how she had been chosen as the author for these particular books, and she started to answer, and then I cut in on her.
Society, or a local genealogy society, to find out if there is anyone in the area who...
And since you are a former director of the Foley Library and very active in the Historical Society, I guess you were a natural.
I got a contact directly from them, and they also contacted Ed Tyson at the Searles Library, and he had recommended my name again.
So they have a very definite format, which I think is interesting. All the books are the same size, 128 pages. They're all sepia, a somewhat unusual size for a paperback, a little bit bigger than most trade paperbacks, but very striking. But it's sort of a formula. They just told you, you pick the pictures and you pick the captions, or what?
Yes, and I was familiar with their books because I had several in my own library at home from places that my ancestors settled in back east in Pennsylvania and Maryland and Virginia. So I was really thrilled to be talking to them about doing a book or two about Nevada County.
And when you finally made the arrangements, were you familiar with the material you were going to use, or did you have to really do some hunting? Some of these pictures I've seen before, but some of them are quite new to me.
Right. A lot of them were new to me also, and especially for this, the second book, The Gold Rush Towns of Nevada County, I tried to find a lot of photos that had never been published before and weren't the same old ones you see, you know, when writers write about the county.
So where did you find them?
Individuals, friends in both the Historical Society and Genealogy Society, and then contacts that other people, you know, knew someone that had a large collection of photos, or just a few pictures of their own family.
The photos pretty much run up to the turn of the century, beginning of the 20th century. Were you told to stop then?
No, it was my choice. But I thought we had so much, you know, good material and a great collection of photos, both at Searles and the Doris Foley Library, that I would want to keep it in that time frame.
And, of course, the different sections you go through, some of them like first residents, which are the Native Americans, you couldn't really find any photos of them from the 1840s or 1850s.
No, that was the hardest, between the Native Americans and the Chinese getting original pictures that hadn't been published. You know, over and over again, that was difficult.
Did you ever turn some pictures down, good ones, just because they'd been seen too often?
A few of them, yes, I did. And then there were a few of them that were wonderful photos, but the quality just wasn't what Arcadia needs. They need very crisp and clear pictures for their publication.
Now, I hear that they have hundreds of these titles out about small towns all over America, and they publish them in very small runs, only a few thousand copies, but they're so successful that they're constantly reprinting them.
This is true, and the Images of America series, they print about towns, cities, and neighborhoods. And so there's a large spectrum, but one of the reasons I think the size is a little odd is they actually print all the books in the UK and then ship them back to the US.
So this is more a standard size for the
them.
UK.
Yes.
After you did Nevada City, you've now come on to Gold Rush Towns of Nevada County, which includes, well, some of them, at the beginning, you just have a whole bunch of early mining history. Then you go into Grass Valley, Nevada City, Washington, Rough and Ready, Spenceville, Red Dog, You Bet, Chicago Park, and a few others. How did you pick the towns?
Well, there were so many wonderful photos I ran across when I was researching Nevada City. And it was just a shame that I couldn't use them in the publication. I had been planning on doing another book. In fact, my second book I was hoping to do was Grass Valley. And because I just didn't get my proposal in quick enough, that was given to somebody else. But the towns that I did choose were pretty much booming towns, you know, in the gold rush and then, of course, several decades later. And so there was a large quantity of photos on those particular towns.
Before the days of automobiles, it seems that small towns in Nevada County were roughly 8 to 10 miles apart. That was the distance you could go comfortably on a horse in a couple hours. But you didn't choose some of those. You chose the ones that actually had mining history rather than being commercial centers.
Exactly, because I was primarily looking for gold rush towns that were a big mining town.
Some of these towns, and now I may be wrong about this, but I don't think I am, a number of these towns, and I'm particularly thinking of You Bet because I lived out there, had a revival during the Depression, but you decided not to cover that?
I think by that time, by the time I got to You Bet, there are you know, several pictures of You Bet and Red Dog in there. But I had so many wonderful pictures of other areas, and I didn't just want town photos. I wanted to be able to put family photos, and especially Chapter 3, where there's foundries, machinery, and mining equipment. Most of the photos in that chapter have never been published before, and they're just wonderful because I think they give us, they give us the visual history of mining equipment for decades.
Right, and I will admit I've never seen quite a few of these. I was also quite jumping back to Nevada City. There were things I had never known. I never knew who Alexander Street was named after.
Yes, I think most people weren't familiar with that information, and it was fun to find some photos that I could write about that had little-known facts about them.
Yeah, and I'll tell this to most of our listeners, probably don't know either, but Preston Alexander, who arrived in Nevada City in 1853, was African-American, and there were not very many of them in California at that time, especially in the mining areas, I believe.
There wasn't, and we had a small community of African-Americans both in Nevada City and Grass Valley. And, again, pictures were rare looking for those families because, of course, most of them didn't stay here. And it was harder to get in touch with anyone that might have had early photos of their ancestors.
And you mentioned, you say he was a miner or a prospector at first, then a janitor and the city bill poster.
Yes.
Now, how did Alexander Street come to be named after him?
Well, as you know, many of our streets are named for local people. And in the beginning, if someone lived on a street or someone could be very popular and famous, it was just chosen for him. He lived in that area.
Are there, and you think he was probably the one of the very few African-Americans who stayed?
He stayed for a long while, yes.
Uh-huh. Was there, what kind of pressure forced the others out? Because I know there was strong anti-Chinese feeling in the 1880s and 1890s, and I would imagine there might have been strong prejudice against African-Americans.
I don't believe there really was. They had their own church here, and most of them were seemed to be industrious besides mining, like most of the population, they did something else to make a living besides mining. I just think that when the older generations died away, just like the Chinese, their children went away to school and they never returned because around the early 1900s, mining was kind of at a decline for a while, and the younger people wanted jobs in locations that were more populous.
When you get to the Chinese, you show early ones in traditional Chinese garb, but then when you get to the later ones, they're all pretty well Americanized.
Yes, and of course, like all the ethnic groups here, you know, that would happen.
What's been the response to these books?
It's been wonderful. Last year when I did a book signing in Nevada City, it was just overwhelming. People were buying several, you know, books to give away as gifts, and some people were buying up to 8 and 10 for their family members. And I think that's why Arcadia has found that they really have the formula, because most generally people don't want to read a heavy history. They want to know about the history, but they like these because it's the history under each photo is brief. And, of course, then the picture again, you know, the old cliche, it says 1,000 words.
Right. And you do show one of the few things that goes beyond the turn of the century. You do show the transformation of the courthouse in Nevada City.
Yes, because that is so well known and, you know, it stands above everything else in Nevada City, and you can usually tell people, you know, any location from the courthouse. And a lot of people are sad that we didn't keep our older courthouse facade.
Back in a more traditional Victorian,
yes.
Classical style. That was redone in the 1930s.
Yes, it was. It was modernized, as our city hall was in Nevada City. And, of course, now they're, you know, older and they're appreciated for their beauty.
Although the earlier courthouses had burned down again and again. And since the rebuilding, there's been no fire damage since, has there?
No, not any major fire damage, no. You know, when we had fire trucks burn just a couple of years ago, we can see even with our modern firefighters and equipment how something so old can go in such a short time.
Now, you say you've written two of these. You were hoping to do Grass Valley, but somebody else got the contract.
Yes.
Are there other parts of Nevada County or of the Sierra that you're interested in handling in the same way?
I'm working on a couple of other local writing titles right now, not for Arcadia, though. I'm working on the history of the Nevada City Library because next year, 2007, is the 100th birthday of that Carnegie Library, and I'm working on a history of the National Hotel that I've been researching for several years.
That was local author, historian Maria Brower talking about her two picture history books, Nevada City and Gold Towns of Nevada County. She'll be appearing in Nevada City at Toad Hall Books on North Pine Street from noon to 3 on this coming Saturday the 2nd, and then in Grass Valley at the bookseller from 1 to 3 on Sunday the 3rd. This has been Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've got to get out of here for Jimmy Icardi's Rock and Roll Party, except it's not Jimmy Icardi this time. It's Greg Jewett, and let's see what kind of a party he has for us.